Hello, it's Tuesday the 8th of June. I'm Andrew Pearce and this is The Andrew Pearce Show, and it's coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Another cricketer is in the firing line for tweets he sent when he was a teenager. Why can't we just let them get on with their lives after they've apologised? Also, we're talking about Portugal, downgraded to amber list, summer holidays now, increasingly under threat, according to the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock. Do what I'm doing, staycationing. But first, he's an infamous child killer. He was given a life sentence, but it appears Colin Pitchfork is going to be released after serving just 33 years. Not long enough for me. So should life mean life for killers such as the notorious double murderer Colin Pitchfork? The parole board has approved the release of Pitchfork, who raped and strangled two 15-year-olds in the 1980s. Justice Secretary Robert Buckland has ordered officials to look into whether he can trigger a formal review. I'm joined now by Chris Dorr, QC, who's a barrister at Millennium Chambers in London. Mr. Dorr, people are always confused, aren't they? Not least me, because when they hear a sentence, life, of course, it doesn't mean life at all. This man, even though the Lord Chief Justice at the time suggested he should probably never come out, he will be coming out after just over 30 years.
Well, life does mean life because the sentence is life imprisonment. And the way that we work our prison sentences or imprisonment sentences in Britain is that part of the sentence is served in prison and the other part of the sentence is served either on license or on parole in the case of a prisoner of this kind. And that life sentence in the form of a life license actually remains until the person dies. So at any point after their release on parole, they can be recalled back to prison under their original life sentence if they put a single foot wrong, and they don't need to commit another crime. They just have to breach any one of the many, many license conditions, and they will be returned straight to prison. So life does mean life, but not in the sense that perhaps most people would understand it.
Yeah, because most people would assume, wouldn't they, with some justification, that life means life behind bars.
Well, they would assume that, but that's unfortunate because it basically shows that the communication of those of us in the criminal justice system and perhaps sometimes by the media is just not very accurate. I mean, those of us inside the system, anyone that sits in a courtroom and listens to a murderer being sentenced will hear the judge say, you know, this sentence applies for the rest of your life. And you will serve in prison a minimum of a certain amount of time, and the rest of your life you will be under license and you can be recalled at any time. So people are rightly confused about it, but as I say, I think that's a confusion. And we could change the name of the sentence, and that might make sense, because there are only actually 63 prisoners in the whole of the prison system of 80,000 prisoners who are serving life with no possibility of release, what's called a whole life order. And so very, very few of them, in fact, of the many hundreds or even thousands who are serving life sentences, will never be released.
Interesting, because, of course, at the time, Lord Chief Justice Lord Lane said, from the point of view of the safety of the public, I doubt if he should ever be released. Now, I take him to mean by that from prison.
No, exactly. But you very carefully quoted the word doubt. So he wasn't saying you will never be released.
No.
Because
yeah.
In order for that to have happened, he would have had to have made a whole life order, which would have been a very exceptional at that time and still remains exceptional now. He was basically, understandably, expressing a doubt, as many judges do, that the parole board would ever be able to assess this particular defendant as being as not representing a risk to the public. And one can understand why he would have had that doubt back in, you know, 30 years ago when these events were very fresh and the murders and rapes had been committed very recently. But the truth of it is the parole board's assessment, and it's only the parole board's assessment, as you say, there's a review scheme and there's the possibility even of taking the case to court if you disagree with the outcome. But the parole board's current assessment is, for a whole number of reasons, that he doesn't represent a risk to the public. If the parole board considered that he did represent such a risk, then he would remain in prison and could remain in prison for the rest of his life if that continued until he died.
Toby, they don't always get it right, do they, the parole board? For instance, there was a great hue and cry over the multiple rapist John Warboys that the parole board wanted released. That was blocked. And we know that the London Bridge terrorist who murdered two people, he was released early because he was deemed to have repented and was being rehabilitated. and he was nothing of the sort. He still had evil in his heart and killed two innocent people at London Bridge.
Two very different issues. So in fact, the London Bridge attacker wasn't released on parole at all. He was released automatically halfway through his sentence on life.
Yeah.
So there was no assessment by the parole board because he had a fixed term sentence of 16 years. He served half of that sentence in prison and was then released on license. Of course, he wasn't in prison for murder originally, and indeed neither was War Boys. Now, so far as War Boys is concerned, you rightly point out that the parole board made what's basically a provisional decision. It was challenged in court. The court ruled that the parole board got it wrong, and the parole board then revoked the decision, and he remains in prison. So you could argue in that case the system worked, and that may happen in this case, for all I know. It may well be. I mean, following that case, this review scheme was introduced, and the Justice Secretary, to whom the families are entitled to make representations, has the right to order a review of everything the parole board have looked at, everything they've done, and if that review concludes that the parole board got it wrong, they can overturn the decision. So that there are checks and balances. This is only a provisional decision, and there are 21 days for which the Justice Secretary can then ask for a review to take place. And even after that, if the review decides that he should be released, then the matter can be taken to the courts and there can be a judicial review. And if necessary, it can go all the way up to the Supreme Court. So this is not a question where the parole board just sort of, as it were, tick a box and the next day he's back on the street. There's a whole load of checks and balances to prevent decisions being made for the wrong reasons.
It's a thankless task, isn't it, making these decisions? Because if they get it horribly wrong, and for instance, this man is released and was then to go on to carry out another notorious crime, there would be such a hue and cry about it. But I mean, how do they make a decision based on what someone tells them in an open prison or in a prison? How do they decide that these people are genuinely rehabilitated? How do they know?
Well, nobody knows anything for certain, do they, in this world? And there's never zero risk to the public. But the parole board do have a very kind of complex and robust system of review, which includes, for example, multiple psychiatric reports, multiple reports from probation officers and others who work directly with the prisoner on a day-to-day basis, reports from prison officers over many, many years about the behavior of the prisoner. Obviously, there will be education and courses that have been undertaken, and there's specific reference to this particular defendant becoming involved in education and looking and even sort of helping others. But the most important assessment will be based on all of the inputs, all of the sources of information, and fundamentally the parole board's job. And you're right, I don't envy them. I'm not sure I'd fancy it. But the parole board's job is to take account of all of that information. Certainly, the principal source of information is not the prisoner directly. In other words, they don't just have someone come in and say, "I found God," and you know, "I'll never do it again," and let them out. There's a whole range of professional inputs over many, many years before someone who committed crimes as terrible and horrific as this could ever be even considered for parole. Hence, of course, he's already unsuccessfully applied for parole. After his minimum term had expired, and this is his second attempt, having been in prison, I think, for over 32 years, from the age of around 27 or so to now the age of 61. And so a vast difference. I mean, yeah, the truth of it is, whether you agree or disagree with this decision, the point I'd like to make is that, you know, people do change massively during their lives, and from their 20s to their 60s, the change that can occur is really quite dramatic and quite extraordinary. It doesn't always happen, and some people do remain a danger indefinitely. And if that's the case, the parole board will say so, and they will say, "I'm sorry, we're not going to let you out because, you know, the risk to the public is too great, and we just can't take that risk."
Fascinating stuff. That was Chris Dorr, QC, author of Justice on Trial, and he's on Twitter at CrimLawUK. And for me, I personally hope Colin Pitchfork never is freed from jail. In fact, he can rot in it, as far as I'm concerned. So why don't you visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with our other podcasts and video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. Summer holidays, overseas at least, look to be increasingly under threat. The Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, warned rebooting international travel this summer is going to be challenging. Last week, Portugal was downgraded to amber list status, prompting a scramble for families to get back to Britain, and no more countries were added to the quarantine quarantine-free green list. I'm joined now by Ryan Howsam, who's founder and chairman of UK travel insurer Stay Sure. Ryan, every time I seem to speak to you, we seem to have one step forward for the travel industry and now another two or three steps back.
Yeah, it's very difficult.
What are people doing, in your experience? Are they just not booking overseas now? Are they cancelling en masse?
It's interesting that people are changing different locations, but in the last week, Spain has started to trend up quite a bit. You know, we didn't used to sell many UK policies. Now we sell UK policies actually more than any other place.
Is Spain more popular, Ryan, because the country's announced that if you've had double vaccination, they'll effectively let you in with a COVID passport?
In essence, yeah. And we're seeing that as a direct correlation with the numbers that are now going there. So absolutely. I mean, it's still down an awful lot from where it was, but... You know, we're seeing that, and, you know, I think the last time I spoke to you, you know, the fact that we can offer policies where people can be covered for COVID in amber and even red list countries means that, in Europe that is,
yeah,
that we can help, I think makes a big difference.
It's extraordinary how you've had to adapt your policies, what your company does for COVID. I mean, who'd have thought a year ago you'd be insuring people about a traffic light system?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, but to be honest, I think for a travel company trying to work in this environment, I think what the government don't really understand, or perhaps they do and they just don't care, is the amount of effort that has to go in for people wanting to change things. So if you think about it, most companies, they'll have a proportion of their overhead spent on customer service, you know, so you're finding travel companies now have got a huge proportion on customer service and not on sales. So because there's so much going on, so it's, you know, so some companies who perhaps put more people on furlough can't, so they've got the overhead without the income. It's incredibly difficult.
And with Spain, Ryan, are they heading for the Spanish islands, or is it mainland Spain they're all heading to?
It's a broad spectrum. It's
right.
Pretty equal.
But it's going to mean when they come back, because Spain's on the amber list, they're going to have to quarantine for what, 10 days, 5 days?
10 days.
10 days.
Tests, but you can accelerate it to 5 days, can't you? You know, so, you know, that's going to help a little bit.
Yeah. Is this the worst year you've ever had in the travel industry?
Yeah.
By a mile. Is it worse than last year?
Well, actually, you know, last year was bad. You know, but people had some, I think, no idea they would continue for a year and a half or 2 years or whatever it ends up being. So there was some level of positivity towards when we can open up. Now, you know, we've no idea. I mean, if you look at, you know, the vaccine rate, you know, the amount of vaccinations that we've had, you would think that they would open up on the back of that. But obviously the other problem that the travel industry has got is that, you know, if you take France, for example, it got us on the red list. So that's like a no-go country. We just can't get in there. So that makes it very, very difficult as well. So it's not just the UK, it's all the other countries and how it correlates. So, yeah, I mean, volcanic ash was my historic worst. Last year was worse, and this is even worse now. And it's like there's no end in sight.
That was Ryan Howsam, who is, of course, founder and chairman of UK travel insurer Stay Sure. Thanks so much for joining us. Visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe, and then you can access all our podcasts, our videos, our opinion pieces, and lots more. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at mailplus or me at ToryboyPierce. So, allegedly racist and sexist tweets from yet another England cricketer have emerged, this time dating from when the unnamed player was just 15. It's been unearthed by the cricket publication Wisden. The revelation follows Ollie Robinson's suspension by the England and Wales Cricket Board over tweets dating from 2012 and 2013, which were sexist and racist when he was also a teenager. I'm joined now by Brendan O'Neill, editor of Spiked Online. Brendan, I hear another player, there's tweets going to come out from another player who was in his 20s, which may be judged by some people to be inappropriate. Where does all this end?
I think it's all madness. I think, you know, people refer to this as offence archaeology, where you go digging into the past to try and find something that could be held against someone in the here and now. I just think it's such a tragic pastime to, you know, really trawl through people's Twitter feeds, look for anything offensive from 10 or 15 years ago, and then wield it against them as a weapon. I think that's such a horrible thing to do and a horrible way to live. And I think particularly with Ollie Robinson, who was 18 at the time of his tweets, and this new guy who was 15, you know, we're talking about very young people, and there should be some leeway for young people to say stupid things and for us to forgive them and to move on.
And we were all young once, and we probably all did stupid things, Ollie, when we were young. You and I perhaps were perhaps a little older, and there wasn't social media around when I was a teenager. But if there was, I'd probably be hanging my head in shame every week when people found terrible things I'd have said.
Oh, I am just so thrilled that social media did not exist when I was a teenager, because I can't begin to think the nonsense I would have put up there. And some of it probably would have been quite offensive as well. Teenagers say stupid, offensive things. I just think that, you know, this the way in which people's teenage expressions are now being used against them in their adulthood. I mean, this is a new low for cancel culture, because we're now saying, look, you said this when you were essentially a child or just had turned into an adult, and we're going to let it haunt you for the rest of your life. We're really seeing how unforgiving cancel culture can be, where there is no way out for people who made one mistake at some point in their life.
And do you think there's something in the fact that the England and Wales Cricket Board, predominantly white middle-class men run the England and Wales Cricket Board, think, oh my God, he's been accused of using racist, sexist comments, Ollie Robinson, we've got to suspend him because of the way we look?
Absolutely. I think there's definitely a situation here where they are making an example of him, because so many institutions in the modern period feel full of guilt. They want to appease the woke mob. And especially, as you say, if it's the cricket board, which tends to be pretty white, pretty middle class, mostly men, you know, that is a very unfashionable thing to be in the contemporary period. And people look at those kinds of institutions, presume that they're racist, presume that they are problematic, to use the woke language. I think what some institutions and organizations are doing, they're trying to preempt a woke attack by sacrificing some of their members, by making a spectacle of how politically correct they are. And Ollie Robinson has been caught up in that. He's a victim of that process. And I think that a far better approach to these woke mobs would be to say to them, go away. We are not going to punish people for things they said 10 years ago. We're not going to do as you say. We're not going to censor people. Go away. Leave us alone. We're not going to listen to you.
Quite interesting, too, that the Prime Minister, who we know is a cricket fan and likes to play cricket himself, and the Culture Secretary, Oliver Dowden, both have waded into this and said the Cricket Board is wrong to have suspended Ollie Robinson. But still, the Woke Brigade have more clout, it seems, than the Prime Minister of this country.
That's the worrying thing. I thought Boris Johnson and Oliver Dowden's intervention was actually very welcome, and I would like to see more of this from politicians, more intervention into these kinds of episodes of cancel culture, and more standing up for freedom of speech and standing up for public figures who are being unfairly hounded. I think politicians should do that more. But you're right, the problem is that cancel culture is now so powerful, the woke mob is so noisy and shrill and sometimes quite threatening, that they seem to carry more weight than the elected prime minister of the country. I think what we're seeing, there is an unholy marriage between these cancel culture mobs, who are often quite vicious and very determined to claim someone's scalp. There's an unholy marriage between those people and cowardly institutions who don't want any fingers pointed at them, don't want to be embarrassed, don't want to be thought of as backward or old-fashioned. So they are always giving in to the cancel culture mobs. And it's that unholy marriage that we've got to tackle. Firstly, by telling the cancel culture mobs to bugger off. And secondly, by encouraging organizations to grow a backbone and to stand up for themselves.
Quite right, too. Because you just wonder how many more players are going to be outed in this way. They won't have a cricket team at this rate, Brendan. How's your top spin? Are you a good batsman?
Well, sadly, I've never played cricket in my life. I've played football and Irish football and a few other things like that. So they should not be looking to me. But you're right. There is a worry here. You know, there's a broader problem now where sport is, even sport, which is the great mass entertainment, even that's becoming woke. We've got footballers taking the knee every week.
Know,
we've got
ridiculous.
cricket throwing people out. We've got the argument that trans women, i.e. biological males, should be able to compete against women, which would destroy women's sport, by the way. So I think the woking of sport is something we should all be concerned about, because we love sport. We love the entertainment of it. We love the competition. And all of that is going to be undermined if it becomes overly politicized.
As ever, Brendan, I completely agree with you. That's Brendan O'Neill, who's the editor of Spiked Online. Now it's time for our regular City Update with Ruth Sunderland, of course, who is business editor at the Daily Mail. Now, Ruth, trend for UK female bosses, of which there's not enough, of course, to be targeted by foreign share activists. That sounds intriguing. What's that about?
So what's happened today is that an activist investor, Swedish activist investor called Sevian, has built up a stake in Aviva, which is, you know, one of our biggest FTSE 100 insurance companies, which has got a new female boss called Amanda Blanc, and it's basically targeted her and is saying, we want £5 billion returned to shareholders, we want you to dispose of a whole load of businesses, and we want to squeeze more money out of you. This is all coming from the founder of this group, a chap called Krista Gardell, who's familiarly known as the butcher, apparently, in Sweden. So we can kind of possibly guess.
Work out what type he is, yeah.
Oh, exactly, what type of character he might be. Now, one of the interesting things about this is activist investors have been a feature of the stock market for quite some time. But they seem to target disproportionately female bosses. Now, another female boss of a FTSE 100 company is a lady called Emma Walmsley, Dame Emma Walmsley, who's the boss of Glaxo. Now, she's got one of the most aggressive activist investors in the US, Elliot, have gone on to her share register, and nobody quite knows what they want her to do, but it's destabilizing in itself. You know, there's lots of speculation they're trying to get rid of her. Now, a number of other female bosses have been come into the sights of these people. So there was a lady called Catherine Garrett Cox. She led a trust called Alliance Trust. She was one of these city superwomen. She had a whole massive brood of children and also this fantastic city career. And she was ejected by Elliot. And they also targeted the female chief executive of Whitbread, a lady called Alison Britton. She's still in situ. Now, what's quite interesting is you're talking about small numbers here, but there are very few. There's only a small handful of women bosses on the stock market at all. So you do have to question, you know, why do they seem to be coming disproportionately into the sights of these largely male activist investors?
Bit of sexism going on here? Is a bit of sexism going on here? Or they think they're more vulnerable? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think possibly a bit of both of that. I think it's probably the sexism was probably unconscious. Elliot certainly tried to make out that they're very hot on diversity and, you know, all of the usual things that are fashionable these days. But I do wonder if there's a bit of a subliminal perception that maybe a female boss is more vulnerable to being forced into doing what they want. And perhaps that other investors and commentators out there, maybe the feeling is that they have a bit of residual sexism that these investors can leverage to use to their own ends. I mean, they do target men as well. You know, you have to say they don't only target women, but it's just noticeable that, you know, to go for two of the most important British bosses of British companies in as many months, it looks a bit like more than coincidence to me.
I do. I do. And let's hope they see it off.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, you really hope that that the other shareholders who have had a long term interest in both of these. Now, you know, another interesting thing really is both companies, to be fair, have performed quite poorly, but these women are new in situ, so you can't blame them for the historic performance. They've both come in to turn round bad performance created by men.
Very interesting, Ruth, and a defiant note to end on. That's Ruth Sunderland, of course, the Daily Mail's female business editor. E-scooters, you've seen them, you've heard them, they're now whizzing through the streets of London legally for the first time this week as boroughs including Kensington and Chelsea trial legal rentals of the battery-powered machines. The scooters will be restricted by geofencing in their onboard computer systems, meaning they slowly grind to a halt if they enter boroughs that have not signed up to the trial. I'm joined now by Ollie Chadwick, Managing Director at ElectraZoom. Ollie, why bother doing these trials? Because everywhere I look, your scooters are whizzing around the streets and nobody seems to put a stop to it.
Well, the trial's been going on around other parts of the UK since probably about this time last year, give or take. Now they've finally come into London with a couple of different providers. Now the idea of this is that it's the government's way of sort of reviewing how they work and if it works well in tandem with other forms of transport, fully legalising them along with privately owned. But as you mentioned, people are already using privately owned electric scooters and have been for some time in and around cities. I think mainly because there's a bit of a confusion that people see them already being ridden, so think, well, okay, I can do that. They see the rentals, it's hard to differentiate between the two. And in much of Europe, America and further afield, they're already legalised.
Right. So what do you want as Managing Director at ElectraZoom to come out of this trial? You want them to be legalised, and in what form would you want them legalised? Would you expect everybody to have to register them in some form? Will they have to pay insurance, any tax? What do you want to come out of this?
So we absolutely want the privately owned electric scooters to be legalised, but are very aware there should be regulation in place, mainly of which obviously possibly an age restriction, 14 and upwards would be our line, which is the same as an electric bike, and sort of a 15.5 mile an hour speed limit, which is also the same as an electric bike at the moment. But the key is, and with insurance, I think people would pay a small, you know, couple of pounds a month to insure them. But the key is with the electric scooters is they can provide a real alternative to people in the urban environment, them relying on already stretched public transport or congesting vehicles. But it's got to be easy and simple for the user and attractive for them. If it's overcomplicated, people won't change their habits.
Yeah, now, and just explain to me how you would want them to operate. Would they be driving, would they be on the road always and not allowed on the pavement? Because I think they're a menace on the pavement.
That's what we would go for and recommend, as is the way with a push bike, on the roads only. And hopefully, as is the way in London and hopefully other cities, more money spent on cycle lanes,
yeah.
which both scooters and bicycles can use in tandem, away from pedestrians and also away from motor vehicles.
I see. And tell me, Ollie, about your bikes. How much would it cost to buy one? How much would it cost to rent one?
So in terms of buying, our scooters do massive range. The most popular run-of-the-mill commuter scooters, if you like, are in the region of about £300 to £500.
Right.
And then with the rentals, they differ a little bit. So you've got an unlocking fee. So most of them are about £1 to unlock, and then anywhere between 15 to 50p per operator per minute of usage. So that's the point there. Obviously, you know, the rentals work well. I've seen them in Bristol myself,
yeah.
Where we're based.
Yeah.
How the big problem is at the moment, it seems obviously a bit of a novelty. If you're a commuter and trying to rely on one every day, I was just trying to look at one and have a go on one, and you know, okay, that one's got a flat battery, or they're not available. You know, fundamentally, if people are going to use them regularly on a daily basis, as you would, you know, with a car or a van, if you're reliant on it, you would probably end up buying your own.
Yeah.
And given the price point, it makes sense.
And where do you charge them? How do you charge them?
So with our ones, the probably owned, they're very simple. You just plug them into the mains charger, just as you would with sort of your smartphone or laptop. Obviously, with the rentals, they're a little bit different. Each operator, depending on the setup they've got, some of them are collected at night,
right,
and then plugged in, and then sort of.
But if you own it, how long would it take you? How long would it take to charge it up for perhaps 3 or 4 hours use?
So I mean, typical ones which I mentioned around that price point have got a range of for about 10 to 15 miles, and they'll fully charge in five to 7 hours, depending on the model.
Right. Okay. And is that seen as a drawback by anybody? I mean, You charge it overnight, mostly, I suppose.
Yeah, that's what most will do. And the beauty of the electric scooter is it is that bit smaller than the equivalent sort of bike, especially an electric bike. So, you know, if you do need to, you know, carry it up the stairs into the office or you know, into a flat, you can plug it in, and they are relatively compact. So from that point of view, they do have a real benefit.
And how do you lock it up? If you go somewhere and you go to a supermarket, how can you lock it up outside the supermarket, or can't you?
You can, in the same way you'd lock a bike up.
Right.
You can use an equivalent bike lock for them. Or, as we're finding with a lot of people, you know, they will just wheel it around with them or carry it, depending on the model. They are that cross where you can manage that kind of weight in picking up. But, you know, if you need to, you can lock it up in a bike rack as you would with the equivalent push bike.
Okay. And your final question, the only people I ever see on these scooters are male. I don't think I've ever seen a woman or a girl on these scooters. Why are they not appealing to women? Is this a failure of your marketing?
It is an interesting point. We found that it is a predominantly male dominant marketplace at the moment. However, I think that you know will change. My voice. I have to always persuade my girlfriend to get on one as regularly as possible. But I think as time develops and it's become more commonplace, hopefully that will expand.
Mm. Is your girlfriend converted?
She very much is now. I think she was a little skeptical at first, but she is. And, you know, we've been out some rides together and enjoyed them. But the benefit of the e-scooter is it isn't really one set demographic. It is open to a whole host of people and a whole host of environments that can provide benefits to.
And just finally, age limit of 14 and upwards. Is there an age limit at the other end? You don't really want people of 90 on these, do you?
Well, I mean, yeah, that's a tricky one, really, isn't it? You know, people sort of argue about people, you know.
I'm not sure they should be driving cars at 90. Life. Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know, exactly. I mean, you know, whether the government brings in registrations of them or a little online course you need to complete before using them, there's a lot of different avenues you can go down. But we say 14 purely because that's the same as an electric bike at the moment.
Sure.
And if you sort of make it higher, people just go down the electric bike route. You've got to keep things as parallel as possible.
Yeah. How long's the trial lasting? Do you know? Is it a month or something?
The trial's due. It's a couple of months actually.
Right.
So they've been extended. The ones that started July last year in other towns and cities. So I think Milton Keynes was one of the first to get going. They've been extended to the autumn of this year.
Right. All right. Well, good luck with it, Ollie. That's Ollie Chadwick, managing director at Electrazoom. Thanks for joining us. Well, that's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m, you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow with this heavy cold. Sorry about that. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.